You're listening to a program produced in 2017 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud.
My mother told me she thought she was dying. Dead as Dickens by the end of the year, she forecast, her pretending not to be scared. So much for Christmas, I say, clasping the Samsonite closed, lunch reservations at Providence, a plan to drive up the coast, a night at the San Ysidro Ranch, to kneel with the ring and ask you. We'll have a lifetime of Christmases, you say, but your tone feels tenuous too. We stare at the collage of photos hung on the wall, me on a small white pony, by the pond, the house through the long angular shadows of the cypress trunks, my mother playing polo as a girl. What if I don't go? If I leave this new life even for a week, will it keep? Will it still be waiting? You push a sheaf of dark hair from your eyes, secure it with a band, the timpani of rain on the roof. You'd never forgive yourself, you say. What if the plane gets hijacked? You tie a tartan ribbon to the suitcase handle. Hijacked, you say. You've already been hijacked. And then he's on the plane remembering. In the middle of the night, that bloody Sharon's car was up in flames, my mother shouting down the phone. I imagine her moving through the paddocks in the dark, the distant flicker, the way she knows the land by heart. The shapes of the concrete water troughs, the shadows of the rabbit warrens, and a siren wailing. The fire truck already on the highway, and my mother breathless by the windmill. She'd leave the gate open, let the wild-eyed cattle shuffle through the clatter of their hooves. And the shadows of those three black horses retreating and advancing, snorting at the Mitsubishi, burning, arching up in fear. My mother too old for fighting fires in the dark. Said she gave up swinging her coat when she noticed a piece of my grandmother's sideboard, an ornate hacked-off corner. My grandmother's antiques had survived the passage from Coventry 90 years ago, but not the wrath of Sharon Wells, not even the bed where my grandmother died with the book of shrubs on the pillow beside her. Then I saw the burnt rocking horse, my mother said. I imagine its silver mane, the leather bridle incinerated. My grandmother rocked me on it as a boy, hers as a child in England, shipped out to what she coined these frightful antipodes. Your father's a sloven and a slut, my mother said, chasing after a hoon like Sharon. My father's name is Early, a family name. Better early than not at all, my mother used to say, but she doesn't say that anymore. He now lives 5 miles away in a sad-looking brick veneer, a coastal subdivision my mother's christened Bitter Snug, after she threw him off his own farm out of the big house and sentenced him to life with Elsie, Elsie being the other girlfriend. I roll my bag along the bluestone path, a lump in my throat as I push the door open. The vague smell of compost and frantic yelping, I glimpse my mother in the dining room alive and mobile, armed with a broom and fly swatter. A brush-tailed possum scratches its way along the picture rail. It pisses with fright on the portrait of Aunt Emma Charlotte, then over the pastel of me as a boy, the innocent eyes that were never quite my own. My mother doesn't notice me, mesmerized by the leaping dog and the hiss of the possum. It plummets to a corner table, smashing plates, hurtles out past me through the open doors and into the warm Gippsland evening. My mother turns. Hello, my boy, as if knowing I was here all along. How was your trip? She hoists the broom over her shoulder like a rifle. I give her a hug, but her body stiffens, as if she's afraid it's too American. Did you get yourself an upgrade? She doesn't wait for an answer, already involved in a project on a kitchen bench, as if I'm a ghost that often appears. Still, I wonder how she's heard of upgrades. She's irrigating ants from a cupboard, wiping them up with an ant-speckled cloth. My mother slaughters armies of them, shows off piles of the dead to occasional visitors. Magpies and noisy miners fly down these chimneys seeking shade. The black and tan dog lies in wait to land them, stunned and breathless on the hardwood floor. On the silent television, the marsupial eyes of the new prime minister. And then he goes out to inspect the damage. A dark hump in the grey light. The blackened frame of the car hunkered among charred remains, steel and ash and wood. Beyond it, the garden fence. The yard that was once tidy, now a carnival of corrugated iron, engine parts. My grandmother grew hibiscus there, black-eyed peas and black-eyed Susan. The cottage door opens a crack, a woman's face, sun-worn, creased smoker's cheeks and bright turquoise eyes, her hair a tangled, sun-bleached nest. Daniel, she asks, like she knows me. Her nipples press at a long, cold, chiseled T-shirt that stretches down to bare, slender legs. Excuse the mess. She clasps her shoulders and blames the boy. A maze of laundry on the floor, but no sign of a boy. Just the skunk smell of weed. In a kitchen I barely recognize, she offers me herbal tea. I have to remind myself this woman lit a fire that could have burned 1,000 acres in the town. But her eyes are strangely alluring. A blue, grinting gleam reminds me of coral, staring back too boldly. Sorry about the furniture, she says. Her hand shakes slightly as she plugs in the kettle. How old is she, 40? Australian years, all that sun and squinting. I kind of lost it with your father. I'm nodding, looking around to see what's left. The floorboards bare, stripped of linoleum. The kitchen where my grandmother baked her scones, sun beaming in on her delicate English face. The Landlord and Tenant Act requires 24 hours notice for a visit from the landlord, she announces, so ballsy. I try to remember I'm trained as a lawyer. I'm not your landlord. I don't look at her eyes as she pours hot water into my grandmother's pale green cups. I know, she says too easily, but I've been having trouble with your father. We've had trouble with him too, I say. Take a sip and scald my tongue. Serve me right for being disloyal, but we don't set things on fire. She looks down at herself, the cotton clinging. It was self-defense, she says. He appears on a horse at the window at all hours. I rarely wear clothes in the house. According to my mother, he hasn't been on a horse in years. I believe he can barely walk, I say. He'd crawl if he had to early. He's at the bloody door at midnight, and when I don't answer, he pulls out my marijuana by the roots. I imagine her in tight-fitting jeans, his eyes out on sticks. He reckons he wants to move back here, wants to die in his mother's house. Well, I want to die in his mother's house too. I feel the grim onset of jet lag. Ruthie owns this now, I tell her. I don't mention the whole 500 acres, houses and all, are now in my mother's name, since my father was banished. I scan the squalor, the sink of grotty plates angled precariously. No sign of Christmas here either. I walk into the bare living room. The munnings gone from above the mantelpiece. The faded print of horses being led back from the gallops with blankets over their loins. I love that picture. I've had him up to here, says Sharon, the roach in her nail-bitten fingers cutting across her throat. She watches me as if gauging loyalties, her blue-green eyes more defiant than tearful. Is she more angered by his unexpected visits, or that he skulks no more? I'll take him to the tribunal if I have to, she says. You won't take him anywhere. Walking back, I make out a frail shape in the dark. On the hill by the chicken coop, my mother's climbing the stile, unassisted, balancing in the dry breeze, wearing only her nightgown, like a sheet above the fence. Hello, old girl. When I was a kid, she says, we used to ride our ponies bareback, help spot bushfires from up on Two Bays Road. She shields her eyes as if we're in broad daylight. I was a damn good firefighter, she adds. A sudden desire to defend the dignity of this old woman. She stands in the dark like something immortal, Eleanor of Aquitaine. You're the reason I stay alive, she says, then boldly steps down to the ground. She walks on ahead through the wood chips by the chopping stump, leaves me split in pieces of my own. The part that yearns to be here with her always, and the part that longs to lose myself in cities far away. Thank you.
Thank you. That was lovely. I really liked it.
Thanks, Jane.
And he had to win me over when he sent me the first draft. I got about 100 pages in. This was several years ago. And I wrote back and I said, is what this is intended to show me that all Aussies are assholes? And he said, maybe I should rewrite it a little bit. But it's really wonderful now. And so one of the things I've always wondered is, in terms of what was the initial spark? Was it about the mother? Was it about the place? Was it about just the difference between Australia and America? I just wondered what was the first thing that came to your mind when you got that developed into this idea?
I mean, I sit up in my office over the road here, a long way from where I come from, and I kind of dream about Australia. You know, it's a place that reoccurs in my dream, and that farm is very vivid for me. And I did go back one year when my mother was ill, and there was this woman on the farm who my father had ensconced in a cottage that had been his mother's. And the farm has the big old homestead, but it also has the house his mother had that was moved, put sliced into bits and put on a truck and moved. And then also the house we had nearer the city where we went to school. So my whole childhood is in these houses from different places on this one farm. And so this crazy woman my father had in as a tenant or whatever she was to him, she went apeshit and started burning things. And so I had to I went back and had to deal with this drama. And the book is somewhat about that thing of moving away from where you come from, which so many of us do, kind of becoming someone else, and then going back to where you started, thinking, I'm different now, and then devolving into who you were and the ramifications of that.
Yeah, I think we've all experienced that sense of that thing that you accomplished, whatever it was, in your new place seems very different when you go back to the original place. I've been to the farm, and I've stayed in the house, and there's something extremely beautiful and simultaneously basic about the property, so that it's not like living in a big estate in California where you sort of wake up and and something nice comes into your room.
Like a possum or a pony. I mean, it's a National Trust, great big old home with high ceilings and ornate things. And yet the room that, there was a reference to the senator's room. It was used as a space for a television program in Australia that was called, I think, Something in the Air. There's a few Australians here, they might remember. And there was a cross-dressing senator who lived in the country, and it was fixed up to be his room for the television show. And my mother just kept all the stuff that they used. But that room used to have a hole in the ceiling for a good long time. So part of me in the book imagines what goes on in that ceiling. And the other thing about the farm is I once went back and thought, you know, my mother's elderly. She's living in this great big house on her own. And the hot water is heated by a wood boiler that's been there for 140
years.
I said,
I need to take a bath. And you said, when should we put the wood in the boiler?
And so I got the electrician to come and put up a regular heater so that the wood would be boiled like a normal place. My father, who is, you know, in purgatory, he came each morning to light the boiler for my mother's water so that my mother, from whom he was estranged, would have hot water. He felt so guilty, and she treated him like a following dog, you know, or a laborer on the farm. So when I got this electrical thing set up, he had it removed so that he could light the boiler. And he's still on the farm there in his late 80s, stacking wood and like cutting wood. And that's his thing. He's like a woodsman on his own farm that's been pulled out from underneath him.
Well, your mother was quite a character. And she was an incredibly, which is important to me, she was an incredibly accomplished horsewoman. And I so remember the story you told about the snake.
Oh, well, I can think of a few stories. I mean, one story about my mother wasn't afraid of things. I can say that. And in Australia, we have deadly poisonous snakes. And
they tell you that every day when you're in Australia.
But it's true. I mean, here the snakes are kind of cute, but not there. So she would be cantering across the field in her 60s on her pony called Bunyip. And my mother was tiny, and she would see a tiger snake in the grass, and in one fell swoop, she would be swinging off the horse with the stirrup leather with her and pounding the snake into the ground. And it was amazing. And she could get on a horse, a big horse, with a saddle but no girth. Even in her 50s, she could just put a foot in a stirrup and get up on a horse miraculously.
Such balance. That's really something.
And she and her sisters were the first women's polo team in Australia back in the 50s. And they played against the men and beat the men. So, the men hated them. So they were these sisters, four of them, that were kind of wild. And the other snake story that occurs to me, we had this Brumby foal that I guess Louise must have mentioned or did mention. I can't remember where it is in the book. But my father went up to the high country in Australia running Brumbies, which are like wild Australian horses, if anyone saw The Man from Snowy River 100 years ago. And there was a mare who was had broken a leg and they had to put her down. And he came home with this foal called Clancy. And Clancy sort of lived in the garden for a bit, and he was bottle fed, and then he lived in the enclosed veranda, and then he sort of moved into the living room, and then there was this big gangly foal asleep on the couch. And one time someone brought in some wood to throw in the fire, and this little snake jumped out of the wood and went up into the cushions on the couch where this foal was ensconced. The word ensconced keeps coming up tonight. And so all the men, of course, my father and I always write like I have no siblings, but I have a brother and a sister. We all sort of leapt out of the way. And my mother, of course, with the tongs and this and that, went and dealt with the snake and the foal and she was a very capable woman, yeah. Mm-hmm. And kind of terrifying.
Well, one of the things I loved about the book is that it's in the present tense, which is not easy to do. And I was wondering if you just came to that eventually or if you put it in the present tense from the beginning.
I mean, it's even worse than that. It's in the present tense first person, which
yes.
They tell you not to do. I'm
they
sure
tell you absolutely not
never to do
that.
It. And also it's told in different voices from different characters that are woven through the book. And they're all in the first person present
yes.
tense. So that hopefully those voices are distinct enough and original enough that they tell the difference.
Mm-hmm.
So I just saw it in that. It was much more immediate, and I could get inside the characters. And because Daniel is kind of a version of me, even though I don't seem to have a girlfriend up in Laurel Canyon at this juncture, what with one thing and another. but I did live up in Laurel Canyon for many years, and so that's where that came from.
But did writing it in the present tense help you picture the world that you were writing about, do you think?
Yeah, I love the present tense, and I love the first person because it's right there. And as a reader, you feel a closeness to it too. And I love that feeling of being inside it. And when I'm writing, I want to be not writing from any distance. I don't want to be looking at something from a wide-angle lens, even though I'll move in and out if you're thinking of it in cinematography terms. But I want to be able to get right there and on an emotional and I write from little bits of memory, like I'll have a memory of something and that'll spur a sentence and something and then I'll write a whole chapter around that.
Well, it makes it very sensual. There are several things happen to Daniel and not all of them are good. And
does anything good happen eventually? It does, I'm sure.
And one of the things I feel as I'm reading the book is that sense you have when you're moving through one event after another and that each event is profoundly present right now, and yet as we move out of that event, it goes back and becomes part of the whole.
Mm-hmm,
it's not confusing at all. I think I quite admired how central it was. And I wondered if the landscape there is what maybe triggered your desire to make it really sensual and present.
Well, it's so familiar that my second book that was set mostly in Cold War Moscow, I've only been here 30 years, it was more of a stretch because there was a lot more imagining to do there. Mm-hmm. I'd been there for a month a long time ago in the 80s, which is when it was set, but I'd been there in the summer and I wrote it in a, it was set in a winter. So my imagination was much more in demand there in a way. But that farm, I mean, in what I read is something about she knows the land by heart. I know that land by heart, and that land appears to me in memory and dream and recurring in a way, and it's my connection to Australia, that piece of land. So that familiarity allowed me access to it. And I had, for example, I was back there recently, and in the book, he's cycling up the lane where he meets with this Sharon woman inadvertently out in the bush, and the was a big hare that appears, and hares are quite unusual there. Anyway, I saw this in my writing.
A hare as in a rabbit.
Yeah, not a big hare. You know how you're driving down the road and you see a big hare? I just passed a big hare. No, an H-A-R-E, thank you for that. So, you know, a hare's like a giant rabbit. And I was back on the farm and I was cycling down the lane, which goes up the side of the property, unaware of the fact that I had done that same, or Daniel had done that same thing in the novel. And right at the place where the hare appears in the novel, a hare crossed the lane where I was cycling. And he was cycling in the book, and he puts the cycle down and goes into the field and meets that Sharon woman. But I've had a number of experiences like that where my writing has been the precursor to things, sometimes more dramatic things in my family.
Well, I'm going to read a little, one paragraph, because I think it's really striking. The dog barks, then silence, but for the din of crickets, the occasional flapping of wings cast up by the night. My fingers throb, my hand rebandaged too tight. Steadily, I unwind the gauze, feel the roughness of the stitches scabbed slightly. Then a vague thrumming, like rain, but far away on another roof. I look for my watch. 2 a.m. Still that sound. Not my mother's radio, no static. It's from the small bathroom down the far end of the hall. The shower's running. The image of my mother splayed out with her neck caught in that chair. I spring from the bed, wrap myself in a towel, wind the bandage back about my hand. And what really strikes me about the passages and about the prose of the book is that there are a lot of sentence fragments. And because they're fragments, they come and go like that. And that makes the whole thing much more sensuous or sensual.
That's interesting.
Because bits are striking Daniel, striking him and going away, striking him and going away.
And I think that keeps the propulsion as well.
Yeah.
Which is really important to me. I mean, the lyricism is important and the sort of rhythm and the musicality.
And the fact that Daniel returns to being a bad boy.
Well, yeah. I mean, he kind of devolves into... I mean, he spent his whole life trying not to be his father, and he goes back there, and his behavior gradually returns to who he was before he left, which is not ideal, as it turns out. I mean,
but it's a good plot point.
Well, yeah, but I don't think in terms of plot, but I guess so. When you talked about the mother's head, I did write that scene with the mother has a stroke and her head is sort of on a chair through the rung of a chair. She is in the bathroom. And in real life, my mother had one of those pendants, and that happened to her. And she pushed the pendant, and my father was the person who received the thing. And he finished his breakfast before he came over. Which is funny, but not because it didn't go very well. Anyway, that's a diversion.
So one of the things that I'm curious about is, you grew up on the ranch or the farm. You call it the farm, but we would call it a ranch, I think. And let me say, having been there, it is flat as a pancake. It makes Iowa look mountainous. And also green. Once I said I was visiting the farm, and I asked
in winter.
I asked your sister. She had lots of horses on the farm, and I said, so I didn't see any buildings. And I said, where do you keep the hay? And she said, we don't need hay. there's grass all year round. Mm-hmm. And I nearly bought my ticket. And so you have to imagine, it's south of Melbourne, about how far from the ocean? It's not very far.
It's close. It's surprisingly close. I mean, it looks like it would be miles from the coast, but from the back paddock, I mean, we call fields paddocks, from the bush paddock to the beach is not very far, but it's weird tidal. I mean, that's a whole other thing. It's not like the beautiful Australian beaches you imagine. It's this weird, spooky, tidal, mangrovey place where you think you might find a body.
But so there you are in this really flat, incredibly green landscape with more horses than you ever saw in one place.
When I grew up, we had 180 horses on the place, plus 100 head of cattle. Yeah.
And every single one of them is fat and happy. Mm-hmm. And you just can't believe that this place exists. And then there's so many other strange and beautiful landscapes nearby. Mm-hmm. So it's really a lovely place.
And you, I mean, if you visit it, you can't believe that I don't live there. And yet,
the log stove is what convinced me that you don't live there.
But I mean, the whole thing about this book is about belonging and home, like where is home?
Yes.
And he romanticizes that place from afar, in a way that seduces him back there more readily. But I can say from my own experience, having been back there a bit now, and having been here 30 years, I think America is my... I mean, I have dual passports. I think I want to be a dotty little old man here rather than there, even though it's beautiful and it would be kind of a great, easy life. There's something that engages me here that doesn't happen there. Not just... in the country, but in the cities as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Trump, despite Trump... Oh, sorry. Sorry. I'm in it for the long haul.
But you also have relatives in the UK.
She died last week.
Oh, really? But you visited back and forth to the UK.
Yeah.
So you have a lot of experience both in the UK and in the US, at least here in Virginia and everywhere else, mm-hmm. and in Australia. So what do you think are particularly Australian characteristics that we Americans might not be familiar with?
I'm looking at Abigail, my little Aussie writer friend, just over there. Australian characteristics, add any if you can think of them. A vague misogyny.
Vague?
Well, maybe not so vague. I mean, it's more sophisticated. I haven't lived there for 30 years, and I'm from the country. But there is what I find the most profound is this underlying anger in the male of the species that bubbles up in sarcasm and a kind of mean-spiritedness. And I don't find that—is that wrong? That's not good for the tourist industry. Easygoing, fun-loving, yeah. And mean with money, like you can't believe.
You mean tight. You don't necessarily mean unkind. You mean tight.
Mean, yes. Tight, I would say. Not generous in some ways, but not in others. And I would also say they are easygoing, kind of happy-go-lucky, not particularly self-aware or interested in their own psyches, which is the opposite to here. I mean, we've got a bit excited about our psyches here mm-hmm. There isn't the level of narcissism, perhaps.
Well, it's interesting because when I lived up in Monterey, and when Big Little Lies came on, which was set in Monterey, the show was set in Monterey, everybody in Monterey turned it off and said, "This is pointless. This is not Monterey." And I said, "No, it's Australia."
Really?
And if you've ever read. What's her name? It'll come to me.
Stead. No?
Oh, well, we'll talk about that. So what would, what do you want to say to Americans that would make them say, yeah, I want to read this?
Oh, good question.
Yes, Christina Stead.
Christina Stead, The Man Who Loved Children.
Man Who Loved Children. The book that is constantly trying to resurrect itself and never succeeds because everybody in the rest of the world goes, "Oh my God."
I mean, Abigail, my friend, grew up in Melbourne in a more urban environment, so her experience is quite different from mine and probably much more sophisticated in a different way. I would say, that's a good question. I don't care if you read my book or not, but I'd be delighted if you did.
I do. I want you to. I care.
But I think there is something about the contrast between his American self and his Australian self and the cultural dissonances, because Australia seems in some ways like kind of California in the 70s,
mm-hmm.
But it's more different than that. And it's like being in France. I lived in France for a while, and the more you know the French, the more you don't know the French, the more different you realize that culture is. And Australia is like that. I think there are more differences than we imagine, and which makes it sort of intriguing. And it's kind of the next frontier. When I go to New York or to Europe now, I feel like this is all great, but it's the old world. And I feel like California is a place where we can reinvent ourselves. I never would have written had I stayed in Australia. I don't think I would have had permission to.
What do you think you would have done, though?
I would have been stuck in the horse world. I mean, I wanted to go to the Olympics. Where's Kathy Kussner? Over there? Frog? There she is, that little white-haired creature in the back there. She, when I was growing up on the farm, there was a picture of her on the front of the Horse and Hound, which is the English horse magazine, jumping like a 7-foot puissance wall, a brick wall, which is, and
that's
she
really
held
big.
The world women's puissance record, and she was my guru as a kid, you know, my idol. And then I came here and I rode in Europe and then on the East Coast for a bit, and then I found her here and I did horse stuff with her. Why am I telling this story?
Because we want to know what you thought you were going to do when you were a kid.
Oh, so my ambition was to go, was to you know, go all the way doing that. And I got in weird Australian teams and went to Europe in 84 or 5 or something and did that over there and rode out of New York and then was sponsored here. And we had a lot of fun, but I never really had the right horse at the right time. Kathy, was I good enough?
She's always honest. Never a person more honest than Kathy.
So I clearly didn't have the right trainer. had
but
I been in a
brave
better
enough?
Environment.
Can you imagine yourself going over a 7-foot puissance wall?
I think the question is, I was probably talented enough, but I was not brave enough, not tough enough.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I wasn't really tough enough to survive Australia in some ways, to survive the life that my family would have presented, because all they wanted was for me to stay and take over the farm, and you know that wasn't what I wanted to do. And someone recently, Abigail again, was on the farm with me with a friend of hers, and my sister, who's a bit younger than I am, who's been out in that sun and working in that world, her friend thought my sister was my mother, and she's younger than I am. And Australia can do that too, you know, that country life, and that sun. You know, there's that thing in Australia where the light is. The quality of the light is amazing, but it's also very bright.
Mm-hmm.
So you're constantly squinting, and everyone's going, oh, no, I don't think so. You know, there's sort of a negativity. oh, that's not for me, no. And that's more of a country thing. But that has an ongoing, you know, the long-term effects of that are kind of serious.
So.
And also, I will say, when I was back on the farm doing this book launch, they took video of me. I looked about 80. I looked 30 years older in that environment for some reason. I don't know why.
So the most complex character in the novel, I would say even more so than Daniel, is the mother.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really curious what you think your mother would have thought of this book.
Well, in my first novel that was called Agapanthus Tango, in lots of places, and then here was called The Great Inland Sea, there was a mother and a father. And my mother, in real life, said, oh, you really nailed your father. And then my father said the same thing, oh, you got your mother very well. So, but I think she would have, I don't know if she would have been a bit hurt, because, you know, it reveals her in ways that I wouldn't have done had she been alive.
So how do you think she saw herself?
She saw herself as the victim of a philandering husband,
mm-hmm.
and having a great responsibility, running this place sort of on her own, mm-hmm. being the brains of the outfit, marrying some cute country polo-playing guy who was you know, 10 years younger and not that bright. You know, she'd been to university, and her mother had been to university before women did in Australia, and she was, you know, very well read and a smart cookie. And my father, you've met him, he's just a country charmer. You know, even in his 80s, he was dying in hospital in one of those terrible hospital gowns that are so revealing and awful. And he really was on death's door, and he's chatting up the nurses. You know, he's inviting the nurses down to the farm for a ride.
He must be Irish. I know somebody else's father who flirted really? Until he died.
Yeah, and it's a thing, you know.
It was a great death, though.
Yeah. That's
for your last things that you say to be flirtatious. Ooh,
maybe
perfect.
It's fine, but the novel is a little bit about the ramifications of that kind of infidelity and that need to charm and seduce and to pursue extracurricular activities. And Daniel, you know, who's in this relationship with this lovely Isabel, who's a bit above his pay grade, wants to hang on to that. He wants to marry this woman. Mm-hmm. And yet the way things unravel back home, it's suddenly out of his reach.
And he doesn't really have a model for how to stay with somebody like Isabel because of the parents.
Hmm. Interesting you should say that. yes. Yeah, next question. What?
Well, actually, you know, I love questions from the audience, so I'm going to make David take questions from the audience, and I know there will be plenty of them. So the microphone's coming your way, and when the questions subside, we'll go back to other things, but I'd love to hear what you guys want to know.
Hi, David.
Hi, Rita Williams. Rita Williams, lovely author.
I am wondering how...
Close to the mouth.
I'm wondering how... Sharing this, both in Australia and here, has changed how you think about yourself.
Were there any other questions? that's a great question. I wish you'd maybe emailed it to me before. I think that I write to work out how I feel and think about things. And someone else has said that more famous than I'll be. But and so my first book got me through into my 20s. My second book got me through to my early 30s. And this book, I think, gets me through my late 30s. So I have a lot of years to cover still, sadly. But I think, you know, it's resolved things around my family. And not to pimp... fiction as therapy, but somehow exploring these stories and exploring my family, it allows me to see that more clearly and maybe put it behind me. And it's probable that having written this novel, I can now say Australia is there, it will always be there, the farm is there, but I belong here. This is my home now. And I love this country and I love this city. And when I first moved to LA, I thought it was the worst city in the world I'd ever visited, and it took me 3 years. And now I spent 9 months or so in Paris, and I love Paris. But, you know, after some rainy days in Paris, I was homesick for L.A. There's something about the energy here, and to me, it's endlessly fascinating here. In Australia, when I'm driving, I have trouble staying awake sometimes, whereas here I'm constantly alive.
Well, I think that's true. I think what happens is you take an experience that you don't quite understand, and you set it up as a logical system. Mm-hmm. And once you set it up as a logical system, you come to understand it, even if it's not positive.
Mm-hmm.
You still can understand it, and then it stops hounding you mm-hmm. and wanting mm-hmm. you to mm-hmm. go back to
but
it.
But I think in your writing, you're more attuned to the logic of things than I probably am. I don't know.
I think it varies from form to form for me. Yeah,
maybe. But I write very organically, so I don't know where things are headed. I mean, this started as a short story that was published in the Harvard Review here and Best Australian Stories in Australia, and I thought I was done with it. And then I heard this voice of this other character, and then I started writing that voice.
So which voice were you hearing?
I was hearing Reggie's voice.
Oh, so we haven't even talked about Reggie. So are you related to Reggie in real life also?
Well, Reggie was slightly based on someone, but having written the book, I realized that Reggie is the wild part, that wild teenage part of my own person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that country teenage wild boy that I endeavor to contain. So, you know, this sophisticated presentation really belies a kind of feral teenager. I can read a tiny bit of Reggie.
Please do.
So this is this wild kid that's that Sharon woman's son, who's kind of living native on the farm, and he's in amongst Daniel's stuff in his luggage. Travel bits and soft clothes, chamomile or cashier, whatever they call it, smooth as a lamb, but make no sense in this heat. I prefer the feel of sun and keep my dirt shoes. I reckon I can feel where water flows underneath. Artesian, Walker calls it. Reckons I could be a diviner if I wanted. Walker's his father. But he reckons too many things, and I'm glad to be away from all the rustling, the things he makes me do. Dig deep and pull a shiny white headphones machine. Says Beats Music. Probably cost $100, and who got $100 here to spare but Ruthie, hidden in her linen cupboard safe. I reckon she knows I take my share. It's not so much, because I can live a whole week on 30. I get my snacks from fridges. She even leaves me some food in the boot room. Anyway, and then someone comes, and he finds this picture of Daniel's girlfriend, Isabel. Need to be quick and hitch up this big white cupboard door. He lives up in the ceiling. Shim my way through the cobwebs, get back safe. But I got even better this time. Put on my big new headphones and press play. Listen to some weird guitar and jerk myself to Danny's girl. So he's this wild kid.
So something dangerous and sinister does happen in the novel, in addition to the original fire. And I was curious about what gave you that idea. Was this part made up? This is what fascinates me about the novel, because here it's very securely set on the farm, in the family, and yet I am sure that the things that happen, the events that happen in the novel, have not happened to you. So what gave you those ideas?
Mm, mm-hmm. Well, Reggie and his father, Walker, and Reggie's mother is the Sharon woman who's living in the cottage. They're the most fictional characters,
yeah.
Although I can sort of imagine who they're based on. And they kind of bring the darkness, and it's about who does the land belong to, and there's something about Reggie and his
and
father.
And the horses.
And the horses.
Mm-hmm.
And there are these three black horses that maraud through the novel, and also a white pony seems to appear. In fact, Louise was saying there are horses walking in and out of everything. But they're kind of the conscience of the novel, the horses and this
mm-hmm.
boy. And as Daniel devolves, this Reggie character sort of becomes the person who could possibly take on the farm. And if Daniel goes, he is there looking after the mother, this boy.
Mm-hmm.
And he's massaging her feet in weird mud and stuff and
mm-hmm.
Doing all these weird things. So it's this funny eclipsing of
yeah.
the power.
Yeah.
And then bad things happen. But the movie is a little bit bookended by fires, yes. And Australia's always, in the country especially, in the summer, everything feels like it's always about to self-combust. You know, there's
mm-hmm.
that eucalyptus, tindery, smelly, about to go boom kind of thing. And I remember
okay.
one day just looking out from the veranda at the house and you could see the bushfires coming down from the mountains. And you're like, you know, there's nothing you can do about this. And then, you know, the wind turned and they went in another direction and burnt someone else's farm. But it's that kind of world.
Okay, so there will be more questions. There can be more questions right now, or we can...
There's one in the front here.
There's one in the front row, yeah.
Yeah, I have two questions. I think they might be kind of related. Oh, sure.
I have two questions that might be sort of related. One great appeal for me in the novel was the sort of universal aspect, and not to get really Freudian about it, but it was like the id, the wild, the uncivilized versus the professional and the adult. And there was this kind of, you're sort of almost like the narrator was devolving back into his id, his unconscious, more savage self.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering, because I thought that was just so beautifully done. if you were at all conscious of that while you were writing it, of that sort of universal aspect. And then the other question, which is kind of related, I mean, I've been in the car with you when you've driven on the left side of the freeway. So if there's a part of you that, even though we're having a lot of jokes about Australia, and, you know, if there's a part of you that finished writing and had some affection for that other side of you, for that, for the Australian self, and sort of like integrated it into the whole, you know, civilized person that lives in LA now. I guess those are related, I hope.
It's a related question. I mean, the answer to the first question is I write from sentence to sentence. One word might inform another, a sentence might inform something else. And I am very much involved in the little scene I'm working on. And so I don't think about theme until someone asks me a question like you do, and I think, oh, yeah, that's it. But obviously my subconscious mind must be mulling these things over, and my subconscious mind, I think, is more logical and rational and structured than I give it credit for, so, because...
You're a lawyer.
Yeah, but not much of one. I'm very marginalized. Very marginalized.
But you have been trained.
Hanging on by the skin of my teeth.
You have been trained.
And then someone laughed too loudly then, probably from the firm. And the answer to the other question, which I'm about to think of, oh, I think that sort of entitlement thing, which is kind of Australian, Abigail?
I'd say American, but...
Oh. I mean, Americans here are very polite on the freeway compared to Australians. Australians don't let you in, I find. And that interests me, because you would think the opposite. So there are things you wouldn't expect. I mean, here the cars sort of peel in from the side quite happily. In Australia, no one's letting in anyone from the side. They're closing up the gaps. And that, it's a little bit like that culturally, I think.
Yes, over here.
What a great evening. I was wondering, were you predominantly the photographer as well? These photos have been magnificent.
About those.
And giving us images of Australia and the horses and your life.
That's actually my father there on Minta and Prince Charles on Bandy. When Prince Charles was out in Australia, they would have secret polo games that the press wouldn't know about, and I'd get a day off school and I wasn't allowed to know why. And that's my mother. Hello, Judy, darling. In her safety stirrups. That's from a long time ago. That horse has a head the size of a coffin.
Are you the photographer of most of these photos, too?
I mean,
too?
That's just a photo I took of a photo of in the house. And that's my mother with a pony back in her dotage. But she had some ponies that she still dealt with around the house. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
There was something else here. A denim-clad woman?
Yes.
Obviously, your relationship to lawyering is a bit frayed, so I'm wondering if you've considered at all pitching a show to Comedy Central with you as the host, a comedy chat show called Coming to America.
We'll talk afterwards. If you could organize that, that would be fantastic. Thank you.
Or going to Australia, just back and forth, one episode there and one episode here.
So that's the dining room on the farm. That's my philandering father's philandering father.
David, you haven't mentioned anything about Reggie being part Aboriginal and the effect of that that story and how that plays out in the novel. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Well, the interesting thing about Reggie arguably being part Aboriginal is that in Australia it's very touchy to appropriate Indigenous people's stories. So that as much as I tried to make Reggie not seem Aboriginal, he actually grew up around Aboriginal kids and was very drawn to the old-timers and much more interested than the actual Aboriginal kids in hearing them and being part of that. So he was swept into that world as a kind of wild, unsupervised boy down in a place on the coast. And he ends up on the farm with his mother after having been with his father. And I knew it was dicey territory, or territory, as we say in Australia, but I couldn't help it. I mean, that was the voice I heard, And that was the voice I kept writing. And as much as I fought it, everyone feels and sees him as part Aboriginal, even though he's not necessarily. It's interesting. I mean, there's nowhere in the book that specifically calls him Aboriginal, but he's very much drawn to that culture. And when I was a kid, I would run around the farm, like pretending to be that, you know, to be those. There was an Aboriginal family who worked and lived on the farm before my time, and I used to have sort of dreams, and I would get up and run around in the night and have fantasies about Aboriginal tribes. And my grandmother had grown up in the very deep outback. She was from Vienna and had married a feckless Scotsman who promised to bring her back from Australia after 3 years, and she never saw Australia again. And she was from Salzburg and was an opera singer. And it took them 3 months to get there, and he went on ahead and he bought this place in the middle of the outback that was 90 square miles. And this woman was dragged up there and had these children. And my first novel, Agapanthus Tango...
She never saw Vienna again.
She never saw Vienna again.
You said she never saw Australia again, but you meant Vienna.
I meant Vienna.
Yeah.
That's me who never saw Australia again. She never saw Europe again. It was in the 1880s. And she had, you know, the Aboriginal tribes warring at the bottom of the garden while her husband was off on shooting expeditions around the farm, leaving for months at a time, leaving this woman in this mud brick place. You know, he was the youngest son of a Scottish farming family, and there was no farm left for him in Scotland, so that's where he went. And so her stories very much also infiltrated my psyche.
Anyone else?
Down
yes,
the front.
Right here, down in the front.
Hello, Sharon. Is there anyone here who hasn't read the book?
Jane asked you a good question.
That I didn't answer?
Yeah, not quite. What would encourage Americans to read your book most? Is it the exoticness of Australia, the feral quality,
you
the
think
farm?
You think I avoided that question the first time by accident?
No, you have a whole audience to sell to, so how would you sell it to the American
public? I think it's the distinctions, the differentness. I mean, reading this book, it's more different than you might imagine. And country Australia is, I left in the early 80s, it's not very different from, you know, that's 30-something years ago. It's not very different, whereas the cities are different. Melbourne and Sydney are wonderful cities. But country life in Australia, as in the States, you know, it doesn't change that much. So it is exotic in a way and sort of fascinating. And the wildlife and the landscape and the expanse, and there's a stark beauty, I think, and the colors, and it's a very visceral.
Well, tell the story. I love this story. Tell the story that when we were in, was it Perth?
At the Writers' Festival.
At the Writers' Festival, and the woman came up to you and talked about something. We were talking about horses, and she talked about something that happened to her when she was a child.
Oh. Yeah.
Tell that story.
So my family, part of my family's business was all the rich kids from the city would come down and either keep horses on the farm
from
or
Melbourne.
Come and stay from Melbourne. And the house, sometimes there were 30, I grew up with 30 children in the house, which was bedlam. And then I ended up sleeping in the meat safe, which was this old place where they used to hang the curing beef. But the hooks were still there, but the dead things weren't. Anyway. So there were all these people. So when I had the book launch in Australia, and it was our 50-year anniversary on the farm, we had like 300 people coming back reminiscing about. And you can't go anywhere in Australia and you say, oh, I'm from Turriden. Turriden Estate's the name of the place. And people know about it. So this woman, who was a writer from Melbourne, was at the book festival, and she had this very specific formative memory about being led out by a boy on this farm at Turriden, and having fallen from a horse, and a stick went through her leg.
Yeah, and she was badly injured.
She was badly injured. I mean, but that happened all the time, you know.
Then she wanted to keep on riding, and after they put two and two and two and two and two and two together, they realized that it took place at their family farm. The person who let her out and then let her go on her own.
She conned herself into being let go, and it was probably me. I was like, okay, whatever. If you think you can do it. Anyway, so yes.
And she was thrilled to meet you. She had such a...
Yeah, she's coming to visit sometime,
yeah,
apparently.
That's so funny.
So the place has a lot of history, and my mother And my father has a reputation too in his way. Like when I split my liver in half, horse fell on me. We were at the country hospital and my father happened to know one of the nurses, oddly, whose father happened to be head of the Department of Surgery in one of the city hospitals. And he came down and operated on me all night for 5 hours, sewed up every blood vessel. I had a horse somersault on me in a three-day event and my liver doubled over and I have a scar right across my middle, which I won't show. You have to come to my next reading for that. My father's womanizing saved my life because a racehorse trainer was kicked in the stomach by a horse who lived near us, was in one of those funny country hospitals overnight, and was dead in the morning, which I would have been had this nurse not known my father.
That's a story.
Known my father.
So I think we have one more question.
So did anyone? You leave equestrian life behind when you moved here? And if not, what kind of riding life have you had since you came here?
Yeah, when I go back to the farm, I will sometimes go out around the place because they like to do that. I prefer to go on a bike sometimes. But that was so much a part of my life and what I wanted to do. But I kind of became disenchanted with that world. There's a lot of sun, and I had melanoma, but that's a tough world. And because I didn't quite accomplish what I really wanted to, I had a lot of fun. But I kind of left it behind because it was a lot about adrenaline and expectation and disappointment. And you live your life. I mean, I would, leave from here on Friday and go to the desert to a horse show or wherever, and there was a lot of organization, big undertaking. I would be on the freeway running up the 5 at lunchtime, schooling a few horses, putting my work clothes back on over my smelly riding clothes, or changing in the car. And it became all too much when I started writing. But I must say, when I was in France, I went to where the Australian team was training. And I was riding a young horse there, and I jumped it, and they were schooling it, and they were going on tour down to the south of France to those fancy places, and they invited me to come, and I was like, oh, wow. There was that thing, okay, here goes another 10 years of my life joining the circus, because that's a whole other world, and that little woman beside you can attest to that, and it's appealing in some ways, but not in others, like Australia. On that
note. Thank you very much. thank you very much. Oh, there's our boy.
Yeah.
Cute boy.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming out. It's wonderful. Thank you, Louise.
Yes.
Thank you, the Library Foundation, and everyone who puts this together. It's a great program. And I really humbly appreciate you all coming. Some of you have been to 2 and 3 events for my books in LA, and it's nice to have a crowd, and so from the bottom of my heart, I thank you. And Jane.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information.